You are listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Tuan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. I'm going to be reading from the current issue of The Cenacle magazine, the June 2018 issue, reading some poetry and some prose, some poetry, and some prose, and I'm scrolling down here. I want to read Leah Friedman's prose piece, Travel Journal, called Same Same Shackles But Different. This begins with a quotation from Albert Einstein. The important thing is to not stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existence. One cannot help but be in awe when he contemplates the mysteries of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. It is enough if one tries merely to comprehend a little of this mystery every day. So that's the touchstone with which we begin. Leah Friedman, travel journal, called Same Same Shackles But Different. Ever since I was a child, I loved to write. In other words, since my frontal lobe acquired the skill for language composition and my fine motor function developed to the extent that I could grasp a writing implement and produce squiggled shapes on bleached and processed tree pulp that would be recognized and interpreted by other organisms who also understand the combination of markings, I loved to write. For most of my life, I have sporadically created travel musings and essays, normally to capitalize on some kind of universal truth observed amidst the shockingly different cultures and sceneries I hungrily moved through. The readily available pocket skyweb picture-taking device impedes my travel writing. When I see something beautiful, unique, ironic, absurd, I don't take notice of the fine details like I used to. In the days before one could swipe a thumb up, press the white dot on the black glass, and look elsewhere. I remember traveling to Canada as a child, then to Prague, Italy, Israel, Mozambique, Brazil, Jamaica, Peru, Latvia, and attempting to immortalize every last tiny detail of something so that I could write about it later. I would try to burn the image, the scent, the feeling, the sound into my brain. Walking back home, I would repeat the descriptive phrases over and over in my head, in rhythm with my slapping footsteps, fearing they would slip away before I could pen them into permanence. Okay, I left out taste. At that time, I had not yet taken up the annoying habit of trying to articulate an analysis of every food and drink I tried. Alas, here in Vietnam, among so many kind and curious people, no one has the grasp of English, or perhaps the cultural patience, to hear my fumbling attempts at identifying coriander, umami, citrus, or fish broth, and MSG, the little devil, it sneaks its way into every dish. I'm staying with a Vietnamese family in the mountain town of Da Lat, 190 miles north of Ho Chi Minh City, in the southern highlands of Vietnam. I type gently on my laptop, not wanting to wake Ellie and her mom, who are napping in the next room. Ellie is chipper, super petite, outgoing, and kind. She's 23 years old, studying business in Singapore, and she has come home for Tet, the Vietnamese New Year's holiday. Chuk Mong Nam Moi says everything in the streets and common areas. This holiday is like Christmas, your birthday and New Year's combined in a week-long celebration. We connected via couchsurfing.com, a social media platform where travelers can come into contact with locals to share food, drinks, and stories, possibly to be afraid of getting molested because you're meeting a stranger from the internet, or maybe to observe that stranger being afraid of you molesting them because they're meeting a stranger from the internet, and even to be hosted for free, as I am so graciously experiencing now. So I'm sipping a freshly pressed sugarcane juice in this not-stranger's hammock. I bought one for each of us, a total of 12,000 VND, VND meaning Vietnamese dong, $1 dollar equals 22,500 VND, so the juices were around 30 cents each. It is dark yellow-green and murky in a thin plastic cup filled with so much ice that droplets continuously form and drip down the ribbed exterior. I can smell the coconut oil I put under my arms earlier. Your skin heats up in the sun, and the warmth melts the oil from your pores. The wafting combination is summery, islandy. It reminds me of the radiant, dark, lovely yogi I met in Costa Rica, from whom I learned this practice, the practice of coconut oil, everywhere, every day, for everything, and putting a cheeky new meaning to the OT Genesis song, I'm in love with the cocoa. This morning, Ellie and her mom, Luan, went to the market and brought groceries for us to make a traditional meal. They walked in with faces full of morning exhilaration, carrying bags of greens, enormous flowers wrapped in newspaper. The stems are conservatively 3 feet long, and pork meat, including chuck bits of bone, bits of meat with bone and sinew from part of the animal that I don't recognize. I've waited for this experience in Vietnam. My travels have graciously led me to the kitchens of many mamas who generously share their secret magic with me. We waste no time getting started. Downstairs, Luan squats over a wooden cutting board on the floor, square butcher knife in hand, striking the pork in even and calculated movements. Her Achilles tendons must be so limber. Her butt nearly brushes the floor, yet her spine is straight and heels are flat on the ground. Her knees are open, two butterfly wings making space for her arms to work on pulverizing the meat. She adds green onion and garlic to this mince pile and continues to hack away. She thinly slices a crisp yellow potato and then cuts that into strips, combining it with the meat mixture in a white and blue ceramic bowl. On top, she sprinkles salt, sugar, chicken stock, MSG, and black pepper. These spices come from identical glass jars. I learn what they are by smelling and tasting a pinch of each after she adds it to the bowl. At the MSG, I cringe and think, well, when in Rome? She squeezes a piece of lime over the top of the spices and a dash of fish oil. She has watched me taste each thing, and when I reach for the fish oil, she makes a disgusted face and won't let me have it. She mixes it in expert movements with two wooden chopsticks. I'm sitting on a tiny stool since my hips can't understand this working at the bottom of the squat thing. The Vietnamese don't have the same affinity, reliance, fondness, I don't know, for chairs and horizontal surfaces. In this spacious two-bedroom apartment, there is not one proper chair or table. It isn't for lack of funds or carelessness. Lots of fancy decorative items adorn the public areas in Vietnam. Benches and tables simply are not among them. Everywhere men sleep on their motorcycles amidst bustling traffic and a cloud of petrol emissions. Everywhere I've stayed, there has been little to no counter space, and at restaurants, the Vietnamese typically sit on what I would previously have referred to as a baby's stepping stool. I've grown fond of having my knees in my armpits while I hunch over my foe. I'm not sure if I can go back to having soup with my legs bent at 90 degrees. I'm following Ellie's lead, rolling this meat mixture into the rice paper, spring rolls, while Luan works the stove, prepping the soup, rice, and omelet of fried spring onion and duck eggs. I watch her lovingly wash an enormous bucket of mixed greens in the sink, once, twice, thrice, until she slices the stems while running cold water over them. The kitchen is full of sounds and smells and affection for the food and for this shared experience. While frying the spring rolls in soybean oil, we stew the pork bits in soybean oil with red onion, garlic, chili, and more of the spices. The pot spits lethal oil droplet firecrackers at my face for a few moments until we add hot water. Luan washes the rice in the rice cooker with the same tender hand motions, once, twice, thrice. Her face is smooth and solemn, and her eyes appear closed as she gazes down. When she isn't using a hand, she tucks it behind her back like a top chef. She and Ellie chatter incessantly in Vietnamese. I suddenly miss my mom, as she would appreciate this situation. I remember her humorous insecurity at the nail salon, wondering what the Vietnamese nail technicians were saying to each other. Are they talking about my feet? They're definitely talking about my feet. Such is the communication style of women in this culture, a pleasant, unending stream of trilled, smiling Vietnamese. There is no way to know if it's about your feet or not. Perhaps that ignorance is bliss. Soon, everything is ready, and we carry it upstairs, assembling three floor mats around a child's play table. The table displays a perfect lesson for me. The alphabet, the days of the week, and the months of the year are all written in Vietnamese with English underneath. It is covered in some sort of laminate that's peeling off of Mickey Mouse's gleeful face. Right on time, aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents arrive at the front door and spill into the kitchen. Wooden chopsticks poised, I wait and copycat my way through. The spring rolls are first, golden brown and crispy, bursting with savory, slippery filling. We dip them in a fish sauce filled with floating bits of diced garlic and chili. The soup is steaming and mildly flavored. The greens are the star of that show, a delight of taste and texture. We sip on the blackberry wine they made 6 months ago, the last time they were in Dalat. All they did was put a few cups of blackberries in a plastic jug with some sugar and covered it. Now the berries have fermented and produced this drink, so sensual and rich. We smile at using our spoons to fish through the crushed ice for dregs of blackberry flesh. The duck egg omelet is bright orange, and I shred it into pieces and add it to my soup and rice like Luan. It has a springy texture, and the fried green onions in it are crunchy. I think about how cooked egg is a nice addition to hot soups. I feel weird saying that because in Bali I was eating vegan and so content with it. Going with the flow there was so easy. There were lots of delicious vegan spots with so much amazing food to try. Sometimes it's hard to flow while adhering rigidly to any sort of diet when you're traveling in new places, especially alone. It's not an excuse because I could do it, and there are a few great veggie restaurants here in Dalat, but more of an explanation. I'm taking things on a day-to-day basis, and I enjoy the bond of sharing in these experiences with Ellie and her family. I don't feel as good when I'm eating meat and dairy. The best I've ever felt physically was when I wasn't having any animal products. All of this is part of my path to knowing how I want to live, I tell myself. After we clean everything up, Ellie and her mom lay down together on their bed, a super firm mat no more than an inch thick. I've done ab workouts on softer surfaces than this. I squat and wash my laundry in a bucket, trying to be Vietnamese, but standing up with a groan, not even 2 minutes later. When I'm through with scrubbing and wringing out each item like I learned in Africa, I hang my things on wire hangers suspended from the chain-link fence covering their back window. I wonder if they'll be dry by tomorrow, as I have very few warm clothing items here, and it is already past midday, so the hot morning sun has dissipated. There's a light breeze, so I'm hopeful, but without expectation. I always feel like I do the bucket laundry thing wrong, and I never know because I'm always too embarrassed to ask. How can a woman not know how to wash her clothes? I worry that someone will think, oh, because she has a machine that does that for her. I hear she even has one that dries everything, too. What does she do with all that extra time on her hands? At least I can wash and dry a sink full of dishes in minutes flat, I tell myself. Are the mid-20s a time of telling yourself all these things? I want to nap, but I hear myself saying it will be better to walk off all of the oil and pork and rice I just ate. I don't want to gain weight. I've been thinking a lot about cultural differences that are actually not differences but parallels of underlying themes. Since spending time with Ellie and other Vietnamese, Chinese, Balinese, and Indian peers, I've noticed that we share different societal shackles. Same, same, but different, goes the favorite throwback Southeast Asian saying. Same, same shackles, but different. In my case, needing to walk before I can let myself rest is the notion of you must do this to be more attractive, or you will be more unattractive if you don't do this. Fatness is a concern, a phenomenon that receives people's attention in the Western world. There is a heightened awareness about calories, portions, exercise, clothing size, etc. in my own culture. A good friend in Bali asked me when I got home from CrossFit training, "You are so fit, but why are you still so fat?" Another friend in Ho Chi Minh City, when she learned I had been a dancer and a dance teacher, said, "But how can you be a dancer when you are fat?" Then she corrected herself by saying, "Well, not really fat, but medium." In Thailand, my massage teacher was demonstrating a movement on me in front of the class. She stopped suddenly and asked me, "Are you pregnant?" "No," I said, embarrassed. "Oh, okay, just..." She bounced arms in front of her belly like holding a basketball. The other white women in the class were mortified with me. All of these people were sweet, polite, careful not to offend in any way. In Asia, being fat is just another way of looking, not the worst thing ever, like where I come from. Tan is something you can be in the Western world, that some people want to be, in fact. Here, on the other hand, you could comb every pharmacy and never find sunscreen that doesn't have skin whitener in it. In Ellie's house, there is soap at every sink that says whitening powder. Before going out, she and her mother dust themselves in a thin coat of white powder. Most of the women here wear gloves, face masks, wide-brimmed hats, and socks with their sandals. I watched this and found it ridiculous. These women are enslaved by an unreachable cultural standard, I told myself, looking around and wondering if anyone else noticed the insanity. This standard affects men as well. My friend in Bali said that only foreigners would date him because Balinese don't like black people. He is a few shades tanner than the average Balinese person. What a thing that people who live in a place where the sun will burn you to a crisp by 8:30 a.m. are afraid of being tan. Then a little voice inside me whispered, "Hey, you, do you not also buy into your own oppression?" Stone in hand, I looked around at my glass house. What was my reality furnished with? Coming from a country with the largest proportion, meals in restaurants and homes, where food is glamorized and sexualized, and the supermarkets are full of processed garbage, hormones and antibiotics fed to the animals we eat from the factory farms, and the biggest craze is being skinny. My brain has hosted incessant thoughts, constant obsessions about food and thinness since I could code memories. As early as preschool, I have memories of looking at the squished flesh bulging out of my navy blue tights, the fat sandwich that happens to your inner thighs when you sit on your knees, and thinking that, one, boys would not like that, and two, if I ate less, it wouldn't happen anymore. As my cognitions became more mature, it was the ratio of my macros. Too many carbs, too much fat, not enough low glycemic index vegetables. Calories burned, guilty that I ate a donut last night, and now I don't want to go out for a run at 6 a.m. And clothing sizes. My spandex are a little looser. Maybe if I keep skipping lunch like the last few days, I'll even be thinner. Should I become vegan? Should I do a Whole 30? Reductio ad absurdum, is this not identical to people who live on the equator, making every effort to be pale? The underlying cause is stupidly obvious to me. Money. Industry needs demand in order to survive. Create demand for a product by showing people that they need it. If you can capitalize on people's tendency to feel inadequate, then offer them a way out. You'll be guaranteed a lifetime of customers. The more people there are who feel like there's something wrong with them, the more people will search out a way to fix that. Hence, a market is created for skin bleach or diet pills, plastic surgery, and perpetual self-discontent. I took a countryside tour with a tour guide who was quite a comic. Lots of dry humor making fun of people in society. We were in the middle of a row of orchids on a flower farm, and there was netting over us that mostly shaded the sun. I asked if the women and girls who were squatting in the common fashion as they picked flowers wore face masks to prevent breathing in the pollen all day. He shook his head and clicked his tongue, explaining that even though we were in the shade, the sun can still tan you. And then you look like poor and work the field, you know. Lots of Vietnamese women, they want to make the plastic surgery. They have short legs, want to make the legs long, so stretching them. They have teeth that stick out like roof, Want to make push the teeth down? Have a big nose? Only good thing for this is can smoke in the shower. They go to Korea and make nose beautiful and small. And the eyes, Vietnamese women smile and can't see sky no more. Need to make the surgery for eyes to becoming round. The rest of the group was silent. Eager for debate, I asked, and what happens if a woman doesn't want to change those things about herself? He looked out at the field for a long time, perhaps trying to come up with another joke, or perhaps because he had never considered the possibility of a woman not wanting to undergo a painful leg-stretching procedure. Not getting married. This woman ugly and not find husband. Right away, I said sarcastically, and a woman's highest objective is to find a husband, right? He patted me on the back and continued telling us about how the flowers get packed up and shipped all the way to Holland. That was Same Same Shackles, But Different, by Leah Friedman. Now two poems by Martina Newberry. 2018. It's been a bad year for everyone. That's what I think. It's been a bad year for the country, for the weather, for fish, for oceans, for old people, for homeless old people, for armies and alliances, for cigar smokers and strumpets. I've been bothered by this enough to make me crazier than they say I am. So I walked over to Hollywood and Highland, stood inside the entrance to the Red Line to take it all in. People walked around, dithered, flitted like uncommitted tiger moths. I watched a tall woman in fringed boots carrying sunflowers in her bag. It looked to me like her feet hurt. It made me sad for her, but then I thought, hell, it's been a bad year for everyone. Second poem is called Village Swallows from Austria, after Josef Strauss. When you read this, I'll be inside my apartment, watching the cat who is watching the birds, who are watching and sniggering at the squirrels, who are clacking at the mice running across the patio, avoiding the ants, who are too busy to watch anything. When you read this, remember that it all started with a window and a cat. If there was music, it would be a waltz. Some haikus by Judy Hagai. Daily arson. Birds wake up to burnt and sing morning hope. Daily arson. Birds wake up to burnt and sing morning hope. I tend to read haiku twice. It's something I picked up back in Austria, because they go by pretty quick. Pretty songs, burning fields, morning salad. Pretty songs, burning fields, morning salad. Soft smell of burnt rides on the cool breeze, yesterday's fires. Soft smell of burnt rides on the cool breeze, yesterday's fires. Homeward bike ride within winds of the desert, seashore air. Emptiness of mind, time to gaze at Jupiter, listen to distant booms. Steps slow down, sounds of nature, sense of ground, slight breeze on skin. Homeward bike ride within winds of the desert, seashore air. Emptiness of mind, time to gaze at Jupiter, listen to distant booms. Steps slow down, sounds of nature, sense of ground, slight breeze on skin. Tamara Miles, memoir excerpts from her ongoing memoir, Same Moon Shining. This piece is called Someone to Watch Over Me. Big Daddy Takes the Wheel. Franklin Delano Miles I, my former father-in-law, is known as Big Daddy. He was like a father to me when I was married to his son, Del. We had only one run-in over the 10 years I knew him well, and it concerned my daughter. Jillian was about 2 or 3 at the time, and we were at Frank and his wife Barbara's house having a meal with them and a few other family members. Jillian did something to annoy Frank, and he spoke to her sharply in a way that made me uncomfortable. Then, when Barbara gently protested, he responded with a remark that only made matters worse. At the table, we all grew silent, and then I pushed back my chair, went to pick up my daughter, and walked outside. The day was ruined, and we left shortly after. I later found out that when everybody was out of the house, Barbara made it clear to Frank that he would not be overbearing to a grandchild of hers again and make her feel unwelcome in her house, and if he couldn't abide by that rule, he could get out. This is a couple who have been married since she was 15 and he was 18, with the exception of a brief divorce when they were still young. It was his fault, and he realized after about 6 months that he couldn't live without her and the children. Barbara has always taken care of him exceedingly well, to the point that she jokes, "If I am ever reincarnated, I want to come back as Frank Miles." So I think for her to be willing to separate from him over the treatment of their granddaughter stunned him. I laid low for the next few weeks, and then he called me and asked if we could go to lunch. He sat across from me in the restaurant and said, "Barbara thinks you're staying away from the house because of me. I want to tell you something. I will never say another word, not a word of correction to your child, because Tamara, if you want to break my heart," and here his eyes welled up, "you only have to keep that grandbaby from me." We never had another problem. I loved Big Daddy, and I never wanted to break his heart. He wrote me a letter when I turned 30, a beautiful, loving gesture for a woman. He bought me pearl earrings. He and Barbara sent me to New York City with a drama group, my only trip there, so I could go to 10 major art museums and 5 Broadway plays, including A Doll's House. And it was he who found my father. I didn't ask him to look for Dad. I didn't have to. One day his daughter Robin said to me, "I can't imagine you being out there in the world alone without a Big Daddy." I think he felt the same. He owns a car dealership, as do several of his brothers, one of whom has a huge place in the Atlanta area. Frank knew that my father had been a painter in Georgia, so he called his brother John, who gave him a few suggestions, and then he started calling paint stores. When he got to Sherwin-Williams in Marietta, the manager knew Dad, and from there he eventually got an address for an apartment, and he put me in the car and drove me there. I can't tell you what I was feeling when I walked up to that door and knocked. When a white-haired woman opened the door, I said, "Mrs. Shelton?" And she said, "No." The response threw me off. "Oh, I'm sorry," I said. "I'm looking for Tom Shelton. I'm his daughter." She looked startled, and then she smiled and said, "Oh, yes, yes, I'm his wife, Esther." I guess she thought at first I might have been a bill collector or someone from the IRS. Dad owed about $30,000 to those folks, I would later find out. Anyway, she said he would be home in a couple of hours if I wanted to come back. I did. My father stood at the door, and we fumbled over our words. Then he pulled out his wallet and showed me that inside it he had always kept a wrinkled photograph of me at 7 years old. Back in the car, Frank watched over me and waited. Crawling. In this section, I'm going to let Dad talk. I met Irene in 75 through her sister. I was sitting in a bar talking to a blonde woman, and she said, "Would you like to meet my sister?" And I said, "Sure." I was 33, and Irene was 46 and didn't look it, had legs like a 16-year-old girl. I went crazy. She'd already had 4 kids, 5 actually, one died at birth, and did not have one stretch mark or varicose vein on her legs. She worked 3 jobs. At a party like she partied, I couldn't understand. She was a cleaner in a pants factory at night, then she would go to work at a store called Leon's, stocking until about 1 a.m., go home from there and get maybe 3 hours of sleep. And then back to the laundry. When she wanted a party, she didn't go to work at Leon's, and she would have a few hours to party. I worked for a fellow named James. He drank and smoked, and it was killing him, and he knew it. We painted houses all over the Atlanta area. Irene and I got married and divorced. There was no divorce, actually, since we weren't really married. Dad was still legally married to Mom until about 1978. When we got married, the first time we got married at J.W.'s house, her uncle. Second time we went to Walhalla, South Carolina. We lived in a house way out in the country one time, but we bumped around from place to place, trailed her house to apartment, etc. Her son Grady lived there in the country house, and her daughter Carolyn, who was about 15. I already had to go get shots in my knees, still drinking, taking diabetic medicine, arthritis medicine, and didn't do me any good. She said she was going to the American Legion. "You going?" she asked me. "Don't you just know I can't go? I can hardly walk," I said. "Well, I'm going," she said. I went, and things happened, and I tried doing a couple of dances and couldn't do it, so she started dancing with other people. We finally went home, and I couldn't even walk. I was crawling. She wouldn't help me out the car. I had little steps to climb up. I crawled to the steps. She wouldn't help me up the steps. We went to a bar down in Atlanta dancing one time. I went out to get something out of the car, and when I came back, Irene had about 5 guys around her, and I threw a bit of a fuss. I threw some chairs, I think. I said, "Let's go home," and she said, "I'm not ready to go home." She was walking out of the bar with the 5 guys, and I got into a fight with them. I got my ass whipped, but we went home together. She changed when she got older and sick, but back then it was terrible. I wouldn't treat a dog the way she treated me. When we split up the second time, I went back to Marietta and started living in hotels. Then, about 1985, I met Esther. Irene had already married again. She had married a guy in 1980, so we must have split in 79, 78. We didn't correspond. I called her one time. She told me she was married, so I said, okay. When I met Esther, she was 71, but didn't look it. I was 46. We were married for the 9 years, and she died at 80. She turned 80 October 13th, 1995, and passed away just after that, so I was with her from 1986 to 1995. She didn't like bars much, although she drank a little. I met her at her girlfriend's house in Dallas, Georgia. We wasn't dating long when she moved in with me at the Lamar Motel. Then we went to live at her girlfriend's house in Dallas. Then we just decided to get married and went to Ringgold, Georgia. No blood test, no nothing, just go see the Justice of the Peace and get married. We lived with her sister, but not for long, and then we put in for the apartment. We lived in an upstairs apartment with 1 bedroom, stayed there about 2 years, then we moved over to where you remember going when you found me, and lived over there in the townhouse until she passed away. I was working for Randy Corley. James passed away in about 1981, alcoholic, died on his bed counting his money. I wasn't working for him at the time. Some of his workers found him. He didn't believe in banks. He just hid his money, but those guys, they weren't crooks, but they didn't steal his money, but they took out what he owed them. They called the law then. Anyway, you might say I killed Esther because I decided I wanted a fish tank. I started out with 1 little one. My stupidity. I had no sense about getting more. I ended up having 10 at one time. That's what killed her. I had a part in that, in a roundabout way, because even in the summertime, wintertime and all, she helped me clean the tanks outside on the patio. I think that's where eventually she got her pneumonia. But I did quit drinking in 1980. I'm glad because it was right before you came and knocked on my door. A long ways on the bus. Dad tells a story of the Sabbath day with Alma. Alma used to take me to church because my dad worked Sundays. She rode the bus with me just every once in a while. Once I got to know the route, I rode by myself. She was probably just showing me the way. I don't think she liked church much. Evangelical, Reformed, Presbyterian. It was a little way out from town, a long ways on the bus. It was about halfway from where I lived to where my cousin Jack lived. His whole family went to church every Sunday. Alma would wait for me at the end of the service by the water fountain. Sometimes she cooked in the morning, and after church we had a nice meal, salad, meat, vegetables. She was a good cook. Sometimes we went over to Jack's house, just me and her, because we had to wait for Dad to get off work. He would come over there and get us. Dad has a cigarette cabinet of Clintons, probably made by the old man himself. Dad's proud of it, and it is lovely. Clinton smoked Rally cigarettes. He saved the wrappers because you could go to Montgomery Ward, and if you had a whole bunch of them, they amounted up in points, and he bought a lot of things, especially fishing stuff. He liked to fish. We went fishing together at a lake or two. 5227 East 8th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. The cabinet is lined with copper because it kept the cigarettes fresh. I want to say Alma smoked, but not like he did. He liked to drink whiskey. You can see where he laid his cigarettes burning on the top. There are little burn marks. At one time, Dad had a leather briefcase of Clinton's, but he left it in Alpharetta, Georgia, at the trailer he shared with Irene. And when I tricked him and got him over here in South Carolina for good, and then Irene went into the nursing home, he never got it back. I really hate that. Supposedly it's at Irene's daughter Carolyn's house, but she says she can't find it. Clinton was talented, smart, and good-looking. I don't think he graduated from high school. He lived in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, the same city where, as a boy of 12, J. Paul Getty had a paper route. This is about 1904. Clinton was born in 1908. I wonder if they ever crossed paths. Getty became one of the richest men in American history, but he couldn't make a marriage work, divorcing 5 times, each one lasting 2 to 4 years, except for the fifth, which made it almost 20 years. His last wife, Lucille, left him because he resented the money she spent on medical treatments for their son's brain tumor and the related complications, and because when the boy died at 12, Getty did not attend the funeral. Getty's father had shaken his head in disapproval over all of these marital failures, and he believed his son would be a business disaster as well, so he only gave him a meager cut of his expected inheritance before he died. Getty proved him wrong about the business, but not until he'd made a risky investment in Saudi land and couldn't find oil for about 4 years. Oh, but then he did, and it made him rich beyond his father's dreams. Did I mention that he wasn't always Johnny on the spot with his own children or grandchildren? When his grandson, who bore his name, was kidnapped, he refused to pay the ransom until the boy's ear had been chopped off, and until he was able to negotiate the ransom down to the amount that was tax deductible. Well, actually, that plus the money he loaned his son, the boy's father, with interest due. To be fair, Getty observed that his initial hesitation to pay came out of his concern for his other grandchildren, and out of his belief that paying off a terrorist only supports further terrorism. Tell that to the boy who lost his ear and whose thank you phone call to his grandfather was refused. John Paul Getty III never fully recovered from the trauma of the whole ordeal, and died 5 years ago when he was 54. In the film Smoke Signals, nothing to do with Getty, but bear with me, the brooding main character, Victor, has to go pick up his father's ashes after many years of estrangement. One of the songs featured is Eulalie's Forgive Our Fathers, Sweet. Maybe in a dream do we forgive our fathers for leaving us too soon or forever when we were little. Maybe for scaring us with unexpected rage or making us nervous because there never seemed to be any rage there at all. Do we forgive our fathers for marrying or not marrying our mothers, for divorcing or not divorcing our mothers? And shall we forgive them for their excesses of warmth or coldness? Shall we forgive them for pushing or leaning, for shutting doors? The ghosts that follow. This is a song by Alison Krauss. I don't live in these rooms. I just rattle around. I'm just a ghost in this house. I'm a shadow upon these walls, as quiet as a mouse. I haunt these halls. I'm just a whisper of smoke. I'm all that's left of 2 hearts on fire that once burned out of control. You took my body and soul. I'm just a ghost in this house. Dad and I have had ghosts in our hearts. It's impossible for me to know for sure the effects of being separated from one's mother and adopted at 3 months, but common sense says there must be a sense of loss. In her controversial book, The Primal Wound, Nancy Verrier writes that children adopted in infancy forever carry the awareness that they were given up, which creates complex psychological needs that affect their sense of self and their relationships. Verrier writes, bonding brings a component of safety and security, which I don't think adopted children feel. Once you've separated from one mother, there's always the possibility of being separated from another. They live with that every day. On the other hand, Dr. David Brodzinski has suggested that while adopted children do search for identity, meaning, and connection throughout their lifetimes, they are not at any greater risk for psychological problems than others. Author Betty Jean Lifton, an adoption reform advocate and an adoptee, called for open adoption instead of the secrecy that closed adoptions can create, the confusion and insecurity. She described the feeling common to adoptees that they are haunted by ghosts of the birth parents. and by the different selves they might have been had they remained in their birth families. But this is not all. They are also aware that they are not the biological children their adoptive parents might have had. Attachment theory and psychology indicates that there are a variety of ways children may interpret their sense of belonging to essential others. They may experience attachment distress or disorders when that sense of belonging experiences a dramatic shift. Doctors Jean Segal and Jaylene Jaffe note that individuals who experience confusing, frightening, or broken emotional communications during their infancy often grow into adults who have difficulty understanding their own emotions and the feelings of others. Attachment distress may be exhibited through avoidance, ambivalence, disorganization, or reaction. These characteristics depend on the type of attachment challenges the child experienced. For example, whether a parent was absent, unavailable, rejecting, inconsistent, intrusive, frightening, or traumatizing. Looking at my father, who lost two mothers, including one who had chosen him and then left him behind for another love, and at myself, who had a troubled, selfish, alcoholic, and sometimes abusive father who then went missing, a father whom my mother had left, well, we are a mix of different kinds of attachment distress. Reading about attachment theory, I have recognized in both my father and myself some of the behaviors commonly exhibited by children with attachment distress, even in their adult lives. Becoming more aware of these behaviors and understanding them better is both helpful and painful. I'm hardly surprised that psychological and emotional problems exist for me and for Dad. He has chronic anxiety, and I have bipolar 2 disorder, a milder form of the illness that is known for extreme mood swings. In bipolar 2, the person often experiences a far greater problem with depression than with mania, and that is true for me. How much of our problems are genetic and how much are environmental is arguable. In addition to anxiety, Dad has trouble with boundaries, his own and others. In my perception, his other troubled behaviors include self-centeredness, blaming, suspicion, neediness, clinging, and helplessness. As for my own, I can immediately think of statements made by my mother and by a former mother-in-law as attempts to characterize them. Mama described me as having a personality that says, "Come here and leave me alone." This characterization fits in with ambivalent and disorganized attachment distress, a desire for security accompanied by a lack of trust, which leads to the conflict my mother describes. I want a loved one close within reach and may experience intense emotional responses to perceived abandonment, but I do not like to be held too closely, and I want to be able to withdraw into myself as needed. Barbara, my former mother-in-law, once said, "When you've been away for a few days or a week and you come back, I always have to start over to be close to you again. You hold yourself apart, hold back. No matter how close we were the last time we were together, how we laughed, talked, and hugged, you seem to forget, and I have to draw you to me." She said this with much love and tenderness. I knew it was true, but had no idea how to change it. Her son once made a similar observation, even before our marriage was coming to an end. He said with a half smile, a half joke, "Honey, I could love you if you just wouldn't fight me." You are listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Toan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Today I'm reading prose and poetry from the June 2018 issue of the Cynical magazine. And we just heard "Someone to Watch Over Me, Big Daddy Takes the Wheel" from Same Moon Shining, which is Tamara Miles's ongoing memoir. Now, two poems by Tamara Miles. First is called Nexus. "The day the corpse flower began to bloom in Tucson, a caravan of African elephants at Amboseli went on nighttime safari. Deep in the dark, a 200-pound calf came calling from his mother's thighs. A boy, hairy, short-trunked, ears like small continents, pachydermis, milk teeth tusks in a diamond pattern, lustrous. A herd of low grumbles made a late melody. At dawn, the grazer browsers looked for breakfast in the bush, Mount Kilimanjaro at their backs, dry lakes looming. Their trunks teased leaves toward their mouths, and all the while, back at the zoo in Arizona, the corpse flower unrolled itself slowly, slowly, for hours, red blossom opening before onlookers, cameras clutched, and I, remote viewer, watched the birth live online. Where the nexus between the now that flowers and the land of elephants in my mind, waiting for the day's first taste, held in the fibrous tunic of my own mammalian eye, fastened on an elephant carcass, bones baked by midday sun? Second poem by Tamara Miles, Underwater Politics. At the center of the cephalopod, a night strobe bulb, fluorescent, gleams under a thinly glowing globe. Below its tentacles, strips of flexible lightning go streaming out like synthesizers, and we are struck with wonder at the sea, planeted as it is with splendiferous creatures, cnidarian stars, cnetophores lassoing their small-mooned prey, soft-bodied sea anemone upended in cylindrical silence, inviting passersby to a seance prefaced by venomous tea and clown-fished appetizers. Though secretly we shudder at predation, at the way even a gentle touch creates the doomed paralysis for those swept in by fate or daring, we are not so myopic that we fail to witness while we wait, staring, struck dumb with admiration for the solitary glories of this space, the corners of our mouths turned slightly up, like crouched and muted sympathizers. A classic poem by Adrienne Rich, a 20th century poet, Diving into the Wreck. Diving into the Wreck by Adrienne Rich. First, having read the Book of Myths and loaded the camera and checked the edge of the knife blade, I put on the body armor of black rubber, the absurd flippers, the grave and awkward mask. I am having to do this not like Cousteau with his assiduous team aboard the sun-flooded schooner, but here, alone. There is a ladder. The ladder is always there, hanging innocently close to the side of the schooner. We know what it is for, we who have used it. Otherwise, it's a piece of maritime floss, some sundry equipment. I go down, rung after rung, and still the oxygen immerses me, the blue light, the clear atoms of our human air. I go down, my flippers cripple me, I crawl like an insect down the ladder, and there is no one to tell me when the ocean will begin. First the air is blue, and then it is bluer, and then green, and then black. I am blacking out, and yet my mask is powerful. It pumps my blood with power. The sea is another story. The sea is not a question of power. I have to learn alone to turn my body without force in the deep element. And now, it is easy to forget what I came for among so many who have always lived here, swaying their crenellated fans between the reefs. And besides, you breathe differently down here. I came to explore the wreck. The words are purposes. The words are maps. I came to see the damage that was done and the treasures that prevail. I stroke the beam of my lamp slowly along the flank of something more permanent than fish or weed. The thing I came for, the wreck, and not the story of the wreck. The thing itself, and not the myth. The drowned face always staring toward the sun. The evidence of damage worn by salt and sway into this threadbare beauty. The ribs of the disaster curving their assertion among the tentative haunters. This is the place, and I am here, the mermaid whose dark hair streams black, the merman in his armored body. We circle silently about the wreck. We dive into the hold. I am she. I am he whose drowned face sleeps with open eyes, whose breasts still bear the stress, whose silver, copper, vermeil cargo lies obscurely inside barrels, half wedged and left to rot. We are the half-destroyed instruments that once held to a course, the water-eaten log, the fouled compass. We are, I am, you are, by cowardice or courage, the one who found our way back to this scene, carrying a knife, a camera, a book of myths in which our names do not appear. And now a poem by Colin James entitled Two Men with Axes Burst into Room, Immediately Become Bored with One Another. So Colin James, Two Men with Axes Burst into Room, Immediately Become Bored with One Another. I woke in the middle of the night around 10. My guest was nowhere to be seen. I instinctively plundered the glow light on the power box. Someone had thrown a blanket over the zombie fence. You can never get used to their desire to get in, nor Sophoclean litter discarded like presumptions. I keep a 12-bore shotgun in each room. Soon there was a splattering of hope, proceeding until reality was quite clear. It was impossible to clean up this mess alone. One must contact the ever-efficient gore revivalists. They arrived exactly at dawn, and a truck with Florida plates, yet emphatically influential, even offering a soothing temporal message. The cleaning was continuous. I never found my guest among the carnage. Must remember to get blood checked for parasites. Colin James, second poem called Can't Deny Yourself the Pleasure. No trees have been destroyed during the making of this hologram. Let me walk you through it. A side view of a hill, long incline without barriers. The brain has its preferences. Someone's handiwork like graffiti without the object backers just nicely hanging there. We used to be able to get dry ice from the drugstore, or was it the hardware man? Don't know if it's an improvement. The hill, alarmed by allegory, approaches, rebuffs, repeats, defers to the crush of you. Colin James, Discontent in the Planet Props Department. I've been out of it for some time, holding this rope, impossible to say exactly how long. We have devised a set of signals. If I get one tug on the rope, I pull Venus into declaratory orbit. If I get two tugs, Mars, etc. Can't afford to daydream, but there are periods when I do. Litter from the many plastic Ono experiments have stuck to me. I'm inconceivably imbued. Don't want to stoop to killing time, but there are currently too many sunsets to choose. Revising the old theory on threes and sevens, my notes float in dead letter data mode. Due for some time off, if you count infinitude. Poem by Gregory Kelly, entitled I Am, I Want, I Have Yet, Fragments. I am an alloy of sorts, a malleable piece of metalwork. I want to be a fleeting aurora, a ribbon come unfastened from your hair, a faint arc whose shimmer is on stage for less than an hour. There is a part of us that is not defined, like white space in a painting. I want to dig in the sand, a repetitive motion. I want to be a being void of dark matter. I had potential once, like a matchstick. I want the light that is within me to be, like when astronomers discovered Icarus and mapped the trajectory, the path the star forged, its 9 billion light year. Explore. Your light has finally fallen to Earth. I have yet to find my existence fulfilled. A little one of my own, as long as I'm at this part of the magazine. Nathan Horowitz, The Feathered Sea. It's 2007, and my father is about to die again. Standing in a courtyard in Vienna, he operates a hand pump from which issues fire rather than water. From my apartment window, I watch, writing with the brisk pencil of solitude. The courtyard burns like paper. My father dons the starry glasses of summer and vanishes in the flames. It's 1998, and my father is about to die again. The city of Quito gently underlines the sky. My father has been recruited to break holes in time. His intelligence blurs the office chairs, giving him twice the impact. With a cobblestone, he hammers my desk. It smashes into crystals like a geode. It's 1975, and my father is about to die again. In Rome, a firestorm outlines my family in broken glass. Unfazed, my father weaves ambulance and police sirens on a loom of insomnia. I open the basement window and glimpse a forest. The humming wind blows in a shivering typewriter. My father pauses from his weaving to tap out disordered circumlocutions. It's 2013, and my father is about to die again. In Ann Arbor, he signs his papers and plunges feet first into the feathered sea. Poem by Ace Bogus. The title is a question from quotation from a question by Gao Xingjian. The book is called Soul Mountain. And the title is, Why is the music so haunting and sad? Why is the music so haunting and sad? The singer died a few years back, unnoticed then. We still listen to his screeching, morbid laughter as he mourns a day when he will die. We will, or the world. The woman next to me has stopped her medication because familiar darkness found her. I'm smoking more than ever as I drive, sweating through my collar, how a priest must, standing up front in his humid church. Still, the songs remind me, and songs don't remember what they said, and songs make everything better, even when they don't, which is more often now for her. Me, I'm all ears, thinking, tell me something, anything at all I want to hear. And the last poem here is also by Ace Bogus, question posed by Rachel Hicks in a Facebook post. If you didn't know me, would you think this was my face? We can't call this sideways glance a lasting impression. We can't know anyone. People we meet in bars along the grayed-out avenues of Huntington are ghosts hopping in and out of frame. At times, no one's finger clicks the shutter button. Did we see that? Did our eyes lie? Even those to whom we feel closest keep their secrets from us. Lovers, hidden bank accounts, the unvoiced urge to hunt big game in Africa because they read Hemingway in school. We don't believe the acts they do, as they deny us our usness, too. Our faces like theirs become vapors seen through azure glass, transient, bending images, until we're not sure what we witness either. Minor characters in stories we tell about our lives. What do you wear beneath the gold party hat? How do you embrace deception? I once said, violence was the most authentic thing I ever did, by which I meant I thought myself innocent and was wrong.